start by seeing if there's questions from yesterday, and I know there's one, so you want to start?
In that process where you had the gate and then you cloned the last bit and then you reversed everything so that you mm-hmm. cloned your previous information, if you were using like quantum information in the beginning, then at the end of the day, like the CNOT wouldn't actually be copying
Right. Okay. So that's a little complicated. So first of all, I was going to cover the no cloning theorem today, so that for those who don't understand what's the concern here, we'll go over it in a little bit. So basically, this circuit is most appropriate for a classical function that you're computing. If you have a superposition of inputs, but you're still computing a classical function, then sure, this output bit will be entangled with the input after this circuit, which is fine because you kind of expect that anyway. And in that case, it's really important, in fact, to do the second half where you erase the scratch bits, because that means that the only entanglement is between the output bit and the input, rather than the input and the scratch bits, which would be, that's the decohering thing. But when this is some kind of arbitrary unitary that calculates some bit, then things get a little more subtle. So the usual situation that you're faced with is the input is not a superposition, it's not entangled with anything, it's some standard thing like all zeros. And you want to calculate some function of a classical, or maybe there's a classical input. Sometimes it'll be classical input, sometimes the classical bit will just determine what the circuit is. And you want to calculate some function of that, but you're doing it in a quantum way. So it's not in that sense, it's a classical function, but it's not a deterministic one, for instance. So if the output has a deterministic value, so that at this point you have some complicated quantum thing here, but this bit is always either 0 or 1, and what it is determined completely by the input, then you're copying it in the standard basis, and then you have no entanglement, and everything is fine. And you can erase as usual. But in the situation where it's not 100% 0 and 1, where there's some randomness involved, then you can get entanglement, and this may not erase perfectly. And there's a couple of ways around that. One way is to kind of magnify the success probability, so it's very, very close to 1. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that next week. But basically, in a lot of situations, you can just repeat the computation many times and kind of take the majority result, right? And if it's very, very close to 1, then there will be very little entanglement, and this will almost perfectly erase this. In other cases where you can't do that, then it becomes a more subtle thing how to deal with that type of problem. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so what I wanted to talk about this time, well, a couple of things. So last time I talked about quantum circuits and quantum gates. And so now the first thing I want to do is tell you about universal sets of gates. So the idea is that we have these basic fundamental gates that we started with, but the question is, what are the full set of gates that you need if you want to compute an arbitrary classical function or arbitrary quantum function, meaning an arbitrary unitary. So let's start with classical. So what we mean by a universal set of gates is, again, restricting to some number of bit gates, say 2-bit gates or 3-bit gates. set of gates, so the set of gates can be combined to calculate any function. So classically, the function is going to be, you know, f of x0, x1, through xn minus 1. Computer scientists like to start counting with 0. This, in the simplest version, this output will just be a single bit, but it could also be more complicated in other cases. Let's just focus on the single bit case. Right? You can have a many-bit function and break it down into a number, a function with many-bit outputs, but break it down into multiple functions with one-bit outputs. Right? The first function is the first bit of the output, and the second function is the second bit of the output, and the third function is the third bit of the output, and so on. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to have a set of like 2-bit gates or 3-bit gates that is going to allow us to compute any function. So how do we do that? Well, the first step is to write f as a polynomial. And we can do this for a high enough degree polynomial, right? Because x0 through xn minus 1 are bits. There's only 2 to the n possible inputs. So if you have a high enough degree polynomial in these n variables, you're going to be able to have any set of values that you want. Okay? And in fact, you know that the maximum degree of the polynomial is at most n, because these are bits, inputs. And so if you take like x0 squared, that's the same as x0. And so the highest degree term you can have, well, so any term is just going to be a product of different variables here. Right? And the coefficients are going to be 0 or 1, because we're dealing with binary things. So those are the only possibilities. So, but of course, there's many different possible subsets of these, right? 2 to the n possible subsets. And we don't have to have all of them. We have some of them and not others. So that's 2 to the 2 to the n possible functions that we have. So that's an awful lot of functions. That's fine. But how are we going to build all of those functions out of just 2-bit or 3-bit gates? Well, once we've written f as a polynomial, we know that it has the form sum of product of xi, where the sum is over different subsets, and the product is over indices in that subset. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to find a way to make these products and the sums. So let's first focus on the case of irreversible gates. So for irreversible gates, I claim that a universal set is not the unique one, but one common one, is the gates not an AND. Okay. So why is that? Well, AND is going to give us products. So for instance, A and B, you remember, we can write as A times B, right? With 1 being true, 0 being false, right? And therefore, if we want to get a product of multiple things, we just have to take multiple ANDs. Right? So by chaining ANDs together, we can get any product. Okay, so that's good. So if we have just a single term in the polynomial, we can do it with just ANDs. But of course, if we have multiple terms, then we have to do more complicated things. Actually, that's not completely, well, yeah. OK. So what does not do in this language? Well, not is 0 when x is 1, and it's 1 when x is 0. So in binary arithmetic, that's just saying we're taking x plus 1. Okay? So this is letting us have something with a constant term. And so if we have a single variable, or, well, we don't know how to take sums of things yet. Okay. So sum, what about sum? Well, this plus, remember, we saw when we had the XOR. So what we want to do is we want to build the XOR out of not an AND. So XOR, A XOR B, is the way it's normally written, is going to be A plus B. And so once we have XOR, then we'll be able to get anything this way, right? Because we can take each term is a bunch of ANDs, and then we can sum them together with XORs. Okay? And if there's a constant term, then we're going to need a NOT on the whole thing. Constant 1. Okay? So how do we get XOR? So there's these various logical formulas that let you to do this, but I'm just going to write it down. So I guess maybe I don't need a new line. So XOR So XOR has two possibilities, right? So XOR is true, it's 1, when either A is 1 and B is 0, which means that A and not B is true, or it's 1 when A is 0 and B is 1, so not A and B is true. Okay? So these are the two possibilities that make XOR true. So now I've written XOR in terms of and not and or. But I still have to write or in terms of and not. And that's, again, one of these standard formulas. So A or B. Well, A or B is true unless both A and B are 0. Right? So that means that not A or B is true when A and B are anything but 0. So boiling that down, you have A or B is not A and not B. Okay, lots of nots in there. So not A and not B, this is true when A and B are both 0. Right? And so then this whole thing is false only when A and B are both 0, which is what OR is. Okay? So by chaining these together, we can get XOR out of and not and OR, which in turn can be written in terms of not and AND. So we get all of these things. And then this lets us sum together the terms to make any polynomial. Okay? So that's one proof that this is a universal set of gates. Okay, so what about reversible gates? So this is not going to work for reversible gates because we're involving the AND, which is an irreversible gate. But sensibly enough, we can do it with the Toffoli gate instead. And it turns out that actually you don't even need NOT for the Toffoli gate. You just need the ability to add ancillas in the appropriate states. So why is that? Well, by putting in the appropriate ancillas, you can kind of duplicate the knot. Because Toffoli calculates this function It takes ABC to AB C plus AB. Right? So certainly you can do the and. So if you do Toffoli on A, B, 0, you get A, B, A and B. Let me write it more explicitly. Okay? And if you do the Toffoli on 1, 1, C, then you get C plus 1 times 1, which is not C. Okay? So the Toffoli by itself with the appropriate ancillas is enough to give you both and not, and therefore is a universal set of gates. It turns out there's also, for irreversible case, there's a NAND gate that combines not and AND that's also universal just by itself. So one thing that's notable is that for classical gates, the irreversible case, you can be universal with just 2-bit gates. But it turns out that you have to have a 3-bit gate to be universal using reversible gates. OK? Any questions so far? OK. So then the next question is quantum gates. So quantumly, we're not computing a function necessarily in the same sense. In the quantum case, universal set of gates should allow us by combining them to get any unitary. On n qubits, okay, and there's various different ways you might try to achieve this. Oh, well, I should say up to global phase. But there's two basic, there's kind of one basic question you might ask. So one is, do we need to get that unitary exactly, or can we do it approximately? So let's first talk about exact. So this time I'm not going to prove anything to you, but I'm just going to write down kind of the most common set of exact universal gates that you'll see around, which is C naught plus arbitrary single qubit unitaries. It's not at all obvious that this is true.
Are these in finite circuits or?
Yes. So certainly single qubit unitaries allows you to do all 1-qubit unitaries, just by definition. It's less obvious how you get 2-qubit unitaries. But then it turns out that once you've done that, by putting them together, you can get 3-qubit unitaries, 4-qubit unitaries, et cetera, with, yes, just a finite number of gates. But the thing is that because there's infinitely many possibilities for the single-qubit unitaries, you really do have infinite possible circuits that you can write using only a finite number of gates. Now let's talk about approximate. So for approximate universality, we're going to insist that we don't want to have to pick an accuracy that we're trying to achieve. Instead, we're going to insist that we have to be able to get arbitrarily close to any unitary. so what that means is if we want to say, this is the unitary we want to get, please try to get within 10 to the minus 10 of it, then there'll be some sequence of gates that will do that. And then, but then maybe if you want to get 10 to the minus 20 distance away from that, then there'd be another sequence of gates, almost certainly a longer one, that will get within 10 to the minus 20 of it. And longer and longer and longer to get closer and closer and closer. Okay? And so that's how we can get away, in the approximate universality case, with just having a finite set of universal gates. Right? And then we can take arbitrary products of them, longer and longer products, to get closer and closer. And if you look at kind of the full set of things you can get, well, if you just have a finite set of universal gates, the number the number of gates that you can get is a countable set. Right? The full set of gates you can get is countable. But nevertheless, we can still get arbitrarily close to the uncountable set of unitaries, of all unitaries. In just the same sense that the rational numbers are a countable set, but they're dense in the real numbers. You can get arbitrarily close to any real number by approximating it by rational, right? Just, for instance, by truncating its decimal expansion at some point. That's a rational number. And you can get closer and closer by looking at longer and longer decimal expansions. So that's kind of what's going on with this approximate universality. So two sets of approximate universal gates are the Hadamard phase rotation pi over 2 on the Toffoli gate. And so that's one that uses a 3-qubit gate, obviously. But the exact universality we could get by with just 2-qubit gates. And in fact, we can do that with approximate universality as well. And so another common set that you might see is this. So it's again the Hadamard, but now the C naught gate instead of the Toffoli, and the pi over 4 phase rotation instead of the pi over 2 phase rotation. Okay? Yeah, so one interesting thing, so this set of gates includes the Toffoli gate, so you can immediately do all of classical reversible computation with that. This one does not include the Toffoli gate, at least not as a fundamental gate. And therefore, it only has the C0 gate, which is not classically universal. And therefore, if you want to do a classical function in this case, you have to actually build up the Toffoli gate or some more complicated using quantum gates. Okay, and there's a circuit which I think is going to be in the tutorial that you can come up with that will combine these gates to get a Toffoli gate. But to do that, you have to actually go out of your standard basis and then come back to it. Okay. So one more note. So these universal set of gates, whether classical, irreversible, reversible, or quantum, allow you to get any function or any unitary, or at least arbitrarily close to any unitary. But this is not saying anything about how many gates it takes to do that. Okay? It could be an enormous number of gates. In fact, by if you just kind of count the number of possibilities, you'll find that many, many functions classically and most unitaries, most functions and most unitaries will require at least an exponential number of gates to get them. Exponential in n, the number of bits or qubits. But some functions don't, right? And that's kind of really where the goal of algorithms and complexity come from, is to understand which functions can be computed in a small number of gates and which ones require a large number of gates. Right? So we're going to talk about that more next week, about how to do that. Okay? So are there any questions about universality before I go on to the next topic? So yeah, so now I wanna to talk about some kind of simple protocols and some general properties of quantum information. So I wanted to start by doing the no cloning theorem. So this is really one of the most basic properties of quantum information, and yet starkly illustrates how different it is from classical information. So the no cloning theorem says that that there is not no device, so no completely positive map, trace preserving map, that takes psi to two copies of psi for all states psi. Okay? So of course classically there's no problem with copying something. If you have any kind of bit string, you can just duplicate it and you have two copies of that bit string. But quantumly, we're not allowed to do that. And in particular, we're not allowed to do it given a pair. It doesn't even matter if we're trying to not do it for all psi, but just for a pair of psi and phi, if psi and phi are not orthogonal. Well, okay, so that's true too, but that's a little bit stronger. So, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to prove the general case, the case if we're trying to do it for all psi, okay? So, so suppose we did have such a machine. Well, then we take two, imagine two states, psi and phi, and they go to psi, psi, and phi, phi. But the state psi plus phi, by linearity, would have to go to this plus this. And the thing is that this is not equal to two copies of this state, the original state, right? Because this is psi psi plus phi phi plus phi psi plus psi phi. You have these extra cross terms. Okay? And so that's a contradiction. This cloning machine doesn't actually clone. It's an extremely simple proof. There's no subtleties here, really. But it's very profound, right? Because it's saying that quantum information somehow cannot be duplicated. And that just comes up again and again and again in all sorts of different contexts. So now it's worth thinking about this a little bit more carefully, right? So I said that classical computation is kind of subsumed by quantum computation. Anything we can do classically, we can do quantumly. And classically, we can copy things. Quantum mechanically, we can't, right? We can't copy arbitrary quantum states. So that seems like it might be a contradiction, but it's not. And the reason is because if you, say, look at this proof some more, you'll see that it's OK to copy things in one basis. It's not OK if psi and phi are not orthogonal. I didn't prove that to you. But suppose that psi is 0 and phi is 1, classical bits. This is OK. It's just that if you happen to put into this machine the superposition, what you'll get out is an entangled state, 0, 0, plus 1, 1, and not two copies of 0 plus 1. Okay? And so that's what I was saying over here, right? So long as you're ending up with something here that's not a superposition, it's okay to copy it in this basis, and that's what the C naught does. But if you do have a superposition, then you'll end up with an entangled state here. Okay? Yeah. Okay. So the next kind of simple thing I wanted to show you is quantum teleportation. And again, I know some of you have seen this stuff before, perhaps in the foundations class, perhaps elsewhere. But I think it's worth going over it for those who haven't. So quantum teleportation is one of the simplest quantum protocols, but again, it's something that's very useful. And so it's usually phrased in terms of a collaboration between two people, Alice and Bob. And Alice and Bob are far away from each other. Alice is up here and Bob is down here. And Alice has some qubit that she would like to send to Bob. Okay. Well, one way you might imagine doing this is encoding it in a photon and sending that photon over this long distance to Bob. And if you have a good enough communications channel between Alice and Bob, that's fine. Okay, you can do that. But there's another way that in a lot of cases is easier. And so that way is that Alice and Bob, ahead of time, a long time ago, they were in the same place, okay, and they agreed to share an entangled state. At that time, they didn't know what this state psi that Alice wanted to send was. In fact, Alice may never even know what it is, right, because it's a quantum state. Somebody might have given it to her, and if she couldn't measure it to find out exactly what it is. But Alice and Bob know that they're going to want to send some qubit later. So they agreed to share an EPR pair, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. So Alice has the first qubit of this, and Bob has the second qubit, and then they go off in their separate directions. So once they've done that, then eventually Alice acquires this qubit, however she may come by it, and she says, OK, now it's time to send it to Bob. But we're very far apart, and if I send a photon to Bob, that's going to be very difficult. However, we have this EPR pair that we've already established. And let's say they're confident that it's a good EPR pair, that it hasn't decohered in the intervening time or anything. So we'll talk later about dealing with that sort of thing. So what Alice is going to do is she's going to do a two-qubit measurement between this qubit that she wants to send and the bit here. And so she can build that up out of quantum gates. So she's going to do a C naught. And let's see, I have to get the Hadamard on the right qubit. I think it's here. And then she measures these two qubits. Okay, and she's going to get two classical bits. And based on these classical bits, well, what she's going to do is she's going to take these classical bits and transmit them to Bob through a regular classical communications channel. And then Bob, depending on the four possible values of these of this two-bit string is going to do one of four Pauli matrices. So I is the identity, X is a bit flip, Z is a phase flip, and Y is both the bit and phase flip. Okay? And it turns out that by making the right assignment here, that what Bob gets out at the end is exactly the state psi again. Okay? And moreover, if Alice's qubit was actually entangled with something else, you know, a qubit held by Charlie, who's somewhere else altogether, then this qubit that that Bob gets out will now have taken over that entanglement. And so Charlie will now be entangled with Bob's qubit. Alice's qubit has been destroyed, by the way, because she mechered it. We just got classical bits out. And it had to be that way, right? Because the no-cloning theorem says you can't copy that state. So if Alice were able to keep the state and still give Bob a copy, that would be a violation of no-cloning. But, and at the same time, remember that Alice can't do a measurement that will tell her exactly what psi is, if somebody gave it to her and she doesn't know. But nevertheless, despite those two things, Alice can still make a measurement here that gives her just two classical bits of information, which is enough for Bob to combine with the EPR pair to reconstruct Alice's state. Okay? So essentially, what quantum teleportation is doing is it's breaking the quantum communication task of sending psi from Alice to Bob into a communication part, sending these two classical bits, and a quantum part, the EPR pair. Okay? Remember, the EPR pair doesn't itself involve any communication because it was pre-arranged between Alice and Bob while they were still together. Okay? So anyway, this quantum teleportation is really a very useful protocol, besides being kind of amazing in its own right. So for one thing, like I said, it makes the task of quantum communication much easier, because you only have to set up these EPR pairs and don't have to worry then so much about what happens to your qubits in transit. It's useful both for long-distance communications, where you want to send a qubit from one place to someplace far away, but also for short-distance communications, like between different parts of a computer. And quantum teleportation is also a useful building block for other kinds of quantum protocols, some of which are explicitly based on teleportation, and some of which kind of use it as inspiration. I don't think I really have time to go into too much detail about that during this course, but if you go further in the field, you'll see it popping up all over the place. Okay? Are there questions about quantum teleportation?
Yes, I guess this is the first usual example for entanglement as a resource? Shared veiled pairs as a resource?
Historically, I think the first example was quantum key distribution. Which the first quantum key distribution protocol didn't use EPR pairs, but a later one did, and I think that predated teleportation.
But teleportation is like more, well, it's both are quite cool.
Yeah.
Teleportation is quite cool, right?
Yeah, sure. No objection there. anyway, it's certainly one of the conceptually simplest and yet very useful applications.
So what does it say about shared veiled pairs entanglement, if you want, or EBITs as a resource for information?
So really, EBITs are, in this sense, a resource for quantum information, right? So what they're telling you is that, I mean, so remember that two classical bits is just not very much information, right? It's just four possible values, whereas this state psi has infinitely many possible values. So one thing it's telling you is that while this has infinitely many possible values, there's not actually that much information in there. Okay, and maybe I'll show you another protocol that's related to teleportation that quantifies that in a different way. But the other thing it's telling you is that this EPR pair kind of can compensate for all of the infinite possibilities here. It's kind of a little philosophical to say, you know, what does it tell you about it as a resource? But it certainly tells you that it's a useful thing.
Wait, I have a question. So
yeah.
If Alice and Charlie are entangled in the boundary,
right?
There's a wormhole between two things in the book. When the entanglement suddenly goes between Bob and Charlie, does the wormhole suddenly like disappear and connect to some other?
So let's see. So first of all, I think even in the context of holography, the idea that entanglement and wormholes are the same is conjectural. But suppose you assume that, then probably what you'd have to say is, well, there's some wormhole between Alice and Charlie in their bulk versions. But there's also a wormhole between Alice and Bob because they're sharing an EPR pair. And so what's going on in teleportation is that this mouth of this wormhole is going through this wormhole and ending up over here.
That makes sense, actually.
But that doesn't really tell you why you need the classical bits. So it's that's at the level of hand-waving. OK. So let me show you another application of EPR pairs that's, well, that's it's very closely related to quantum teleportation. And that's super dense coding. So again, we have Alice and Bob. And again, they're going to be far apart, but had time to pre-share some entanglement. Now, this time, Alice wants to send classical bits to Bob. Okay. And instead of using a classical communication channel, they actually have a good quantum communication channel. And so obviously, she should just send one classical bit over this quantum communication channel by encoding it as a qubit and just ignoring the possibility of superposition. But superdense coding says you can actually do better than that. And in fact, by sending one qubit plus using up one EPR pair, we're going to be able to send two classical bits. Okay. Whereas this one is saying one EPR pair plus two classical bits lets you send one qubit. So it's kind of switching the size of these two things. So how does that work? Well, Alice has two classical bits. And she's going to use these to tell her to apply one of these four polys. Okay. And then once she has she's going to apply that to her half of the EPR pair. And then she takes her qubit and sends it through this quantum communication channel. And then Bob has a two-qubit state, and he wants to do this Bell measurement. Okay, and once he does that, he gets two classical bits, which, if they've done everything right, and I drew everything right, are exactly the two bits that Alice wanted to send. Okay, so the point is that there's four possible states that you can get here. And if you look at what happens with these four poly matrices, they're going to be four orthogonal states. Right? We have 0, 0, plus 1, 1 if we had the identity. If we have x, well, we're flipping the first bit. So we have 1, 0, plus 0, 1. If we have y up to global phase, we have 1, 0, minus 0, 1. And if we have z, we have 0, 0, minus 1, 1. So you can easily see that these two are orthogonal to these two, because these are superpositions of 0 and 0 and 1, 1. And these are 1, 0, and 1, 1, 0, 1. It's maybe a little less obvious that this and this are orthogonal, but still not hard to see. And similarly, this and this. Okay, so all four of these are orthogonal states. So you know there has to be a measurement that will distinguish them in a two-qubit Hilbert space. And this is the measurement. Okay. So by pre-sharing this entanglement, they're able to send more classical bits than they're sending qubits. So in some sense, you might say one qubit is equal to two classical bits. But actually, it turns out that's only true if you already have this EPR pair. If you try to send qubits from Alice to Bob without some pre-shared entangled state, she's only going to be able to send one classical bit per qubit that she sends. OK? Any questions on these?
Can you like generalize this to like an arbitrary number of bits?
So for instance, if you do this n times, then you can send 2n classical bits using n qubits and n EPR pairs. But you can't send 3 classical bits using just 1 qubit and 1 EPR pair. This is the limit. This is the most you can do. You can certainly say, okay, I'm gonna do many more different unitaries here for however many possibilities you have. But then the states you get out here are not orthogonal states, right? It's only a 4-dimensional Hilbert space, 2 qubits. So you can have at most 4 orthogonal states here. Right? So in general, that's going to be the case, right? If you have, So there's a lot that one could say here. But the point is that there's this property of monogamy of entanglement that I'm not going to go into, probably. If we're sending you know n qubits here, that can only be maximum entangled with n qubits down here, which means we have a total of 2 n qubits here, and that kind of limits the total amount of information we can get out. Any other questions? Okay, so in the last 10 minutes, I want to talk about the notion of distance between quantum states. So I alluded to this earlier when I was talking about approximate universality. I said you could get very close to different unitaries. Actually, I'm not even going to talk about that. I'm just going to talk about what it means for two states to be close to each other. intuitively, it's maybe pretty obvious, but we would like to be able to quantify that. There's a lot of context in where we want to have an exact statement of how far two things are apart. And there's two separate notions of distance that come up very often that I want to cover. So Aggie, do we know if the boards are working?
No,
still not. Okay. So let's go back over here. Okay, so the first notion of distance is fidelity. So the fidelity of pure states is kind of an obvious thing. So if you have two states, phi and psi, you can take their inner product, right? And if the states are the same, the inner product is 1. If the states are not the same, the inner product is going to be less than 1. But there's one problem with this quantity as I've written it, which is that it can also be negative or complex, and that's kind of annoying. So what we normally do to take the fidelity is we take the absolute value. Okay? And now we have something between 0 and 1. If it's 0, they're orthogonal. If it's 1, they're the same up to global phase, which doesn't matter. And if it's somewhere in between, then they're non-orthogonal but not identical. Okay? And so one nice thing about the fidelity is it has an operational meaning. Specifically, if you have a state that you want to be psi, you think is psi, but you're afraid it might be phi, then fidelity kind of quantifies the probability that you're wrong about that. Or that in particular, if you make the measurement, between psi and the perpendicular subspace. So if you actually have psi, then you get the first outcome always. But if you actually have phi, then you only get the first outcome with probability f squared, the fidelity squared. Okay? So this kind of gives you a concrete problem, a concrete task, the fidelity is the answer to, or at least the fidelity squared is the answer to. Okay? So that's what we mean by an operational interpretation of this quantity. Okay. So, but the problem is that as I've written it, this is only between two pure states. And more generally, we might have mixed states, and we might want to know the distance between them. Now, the distance between a pure state and a mixed state, there's kind of an obvious generalization of this, right? So if we have the fidelity between psi and some mixed state sigma, well, it's actually the squared fidelity I'm going to write down. So that's just the trace of psi with sigma. Right? And you see that this is a generalization of that, because if you stick in a pure state for sigma, you'll get absolute value of psi, well, if sigma is phi, pure state phi, you get psi phi squared. Okay? But that's only part of the story, and it's actually much, much more difficult to figure out what the fidelity is between rho and sigma. And so I'm just going to write down a formula, which looks a bit strange, which is the trace of the square root of rho to the 1/2 sigma rho to the 1/2. Okay? Now, I mean, kind of staring at this, you can kind of see how it's related to this, right? This square root is taking this square here, and if you imagine, you know, using simplicity to move this rho to the 1/2 in front, you get trace of rho sigma, which is kind of like this. But actually, trace of rho sigma is square root of trace of rho sigma is not the right answer. It gives you something that doesn't behave in the right way. You have to take this weird combination, and the square root has to be inside the trace, and you need to, and then once you have the square root, you can't shift the rho to the 1/2 in front anymore. So this is the right formula. And the way we know it's the right formula is that it has a bunch of properties that we expect the fidelity to have. Let's see, am I going to be able to fit them there? Okay. Let's try. Actually, let's not try. Let's write them here. Okay, what properties does the fidelity have? So the first one is that it's between 0 and 1. I guess even that is maybe not totally obvious, but that's not too hard. Second one is that the fidelity of two states is 1 if and only if they're the same. And at least this direction is not too hard to see, because when rho is equal to sigma, then you really can move this rho to the 1/2 through the sigma, and then you get sigma squared, square root of sigma squared is sigma, and then trace of sigma is 1, because it's a density matrix. It's maybe less obvious the other way, but also true. So the fidelity is 0 if and only if rho and sigma have orthogonal support. So if rho is a mixture of states on one subspace and sigma is a mixture of states on an orthogonal subspace, then they have zero fidelity. Just like if they're pure states, they have zero fidelity if they're orthogonal to each other. So f of rho sigma is equal to f of sigma rho, which, you know, is not at all obvious looking at this formula, but it's true. Okay, and now we get to some of the more, some of the more structured ones. So if you take rho and sigma and some other basis, you do some unitary, conjugate rho and sigma by this unitary, then the fidelity between the resulting states is equal to the fidelity between the initial states. So fidelity is unitarily invariant. Okay? That's an important property because it means that it's not dependent on your choice of basis. And I guess this you can pretty much see directly because these are all basis invariant quantities in this formula. Okay, and if instead you take a completely positive map, so if you take rho and sigma and you do something to them, some arbitrary, completely positive phrase-preserving map, it should be that they only get closer together, right? You shouldn't be able to increase the distinguishability of rho and sigma by doing some quantum operation to them, because that would allow you to get more information out than you should be allowed, right? You can only distinguish non-orthogonal states by a certain amount, and if there was some completely positive map that would make the fidelity lower, then that would let you get more, right? So this has to be greater than or equal to fidelity B between rho and sigma for all completely positive phrase preserving E. Okay? And then finally, this one is sufficiently important and non-trivial that it has its own name. It's called Ullmann's theorem. It says the fidelity between two density matrices, rho and sigma, is equal to the maximum between two states psi and phi of the fidelity between psi and phi. Where the maximum is taken over purifications of rho and sigma. So purification is, so psi and phi are going to be states on your original system plus some reference system. And then you take the trace over the reference system R, and you get rho and trace over R of phi is equal to sigma. Okay? So remember that mixed states, you can think of them in two different ways. So one of those ways is to say it's a mixture of different pure states with different probabilities of having different pure states. The other way of thinking about it is what's called an improper mixture, which is to say it's actually part of an entangled state where you've traced over part of it. And every density matrix can be written in this way as a pure state where you've traced over part of it. But moreover, it can be written non-uniquely. There's multiple different pure states that it could work. And so what Ullmann's theorem is saying is that if you take such a purification of rho and such a purification of sigma and make those two purifications as close together as possible, then the fidelity between those two pure states is equal to the fidelity between the density matrices. And it's Ullmann's theorem that really tells us once and for all that this is in fact the right definition of fidelity, that it's really the correct generalization of the pure state case. Now, I should point out that tracing over a qubit is the same as discarding it, or some reference system, the same as discarding it, which is a valid, completely positive phrase-preserving map. So in general, if you take psi and phi that are purifications of rho and sigma without doing this maximization, and then trace over R, you're going to get rho and sigma back, but the fidelity might increase when you do that. And so this is saying that if you pick the best possible ones, then, which is saying that the purifications are more distinguishable, right? And they're more distinguishable because there's kind of extra information in the purified part, in the reference system, that's helping you tell them apart. But if you take the best possible choice, there isn't that information. All the distinguishing information is already present in your original system. Okay? Okay, I am out of time, but let me just take another couple of minutes to define another notion of distance, which is the trace distance. So the trace distance between rho and sigma is a half trace absolute value of rho minus sigma. And this is a generalization of a classical concept. If rho and sigma are diagonal, you get a classical notion called the statistical distance sometimes. This trace distance is also known as the one norm. For reasons that I don't really want to get into. Okay, and it also has an operational interpretation, which is that so if you take the best POVM, and try to distinguish rho and sigma, of the classical, sorry, it's the maximum of the statistical distance. Over P of N, you try to distinguish rho and sigma. So you have some measurement that you want to make. You want to make the best possible guess as to which you have rho or sigma. This is a little different from what you do in fidelity, where you think it's one and you make the measurement that will tell you if there's an error. In this case, you have no kind of prejudice of one over the other. You're just trying to make your best guess between them. And then once you do that, the probability of a correct guess is 1/2 1 plus d of rho sigma. Okay. And this trace distance has a bunch of properties, most of which are similar to the properties of fidelity. So again, it's between 0 and 1. But one difference is that it's reversed, right? So if rho and sigma are the same, then this is equal to 0, right? Trace of rho minus rho is 0. And that's if and only if. Whereas d and rho sigma are equal to 1 when they have orthogonal support, although I guess I didn't write that down as a property. So it's symmetric. That one's more obvious than for fidelity. You have a triangle inequality. And so that tells you the trace distance is an actual distance. And it's also unitarily invariant. And non-increasing. under CP maps. Okay. So, right, so this is just a separate notion of distance, which gives us two different ways to say whether some two states are close, right? They can be close because they have high fidelity, or they can be close because they have low trace distance. And it turns out they are related, but only kind of very roughly. So in particular, there's a formula that says that 1 minus fidelity is less than or equal to trace distance, which is less than or equal to the square root of 1 minus fidelity squared. Okay. So if you actually want to say, if you want to say that two states are close, they're going to be close in one if they're close in the other. But how close, that depends on the exact details of the states. It could be that they're close up to square root, or it could be that they're close up to the same amount. Okay. And so for some problems of fidelity, if you want to talk about states being close, for some problems of fidelity is a good measure to use. For other problems, the trace distance is a better measure. Okay, yeah.
Why is there distance decreasing after measurements?
Yeah. So again, distance, right, remember, this is the opposite of fidelity. So closer together means that they're more similar. So CPTP map can lose information that helps you distinguish the states, but it can't gain information that helps you distinguish. So they have to get closer together, which means lower resistance.
Okay.
Right? Think about it in terms of this theorem, right? Your probability of guessing which is which has to go down after you've done something to them, right? It can't go up.
I see. What are you doing over here exactly when you're picking the maximum over POVMs to distinguish between the two?
So it turns out that, I can even tell you what the best POVM is, which is you look at this operator rho minus sigma. It'll have some positive eigenvalues and some negative eigenvalues. It has its trace of rho minus sigma without the absolute value is 0. So it'll have some positive eigenvalues, some negative eigenvalues. And so you make, if you think of them, the easiest case is to think when these are both diagonal in the same basis, right? And then there'll be some cases where rho has an eigenvalue that's bigger than sigma, and some cases where it's less. So that means that rho is more likely to be the cases where it's higher one, and less likely to be the case where it's lower one. So in this basis where rho minus sigma is diagonal, you just make the POVM that projects on those two subspaces. And if you pick the subspace where rho is bigger, where the eigenvalue of this difference is positive, then you choose rho. And if it's the one where it's negative, then you choose sigma.
Okay. I see. And so this is, so if I did that POVM and I found that it was a plus, and then I said it was, and then I decided that it was rho, then this is the probability that it really is rho.
Yes, but without all those conditionals. So this is the probability that if you follow this procedure that I said,
yeah, you'd be right.
That you'll be right.
Okay.
Can you read the absolute value of the trace of the difference?
No, it's the trace of the absolute value. So the trace of the difference is 0. Because the trace is additive. So trace of rho is equal to trace of sigma. So the trace of rho minus sigma is 0. So it has to be the trace of the absolute value. Which is saying that you add up all the positive eigenvalues and add up the absolute value and subtract off the total of the negative eigenvalues, or add the absolute value of the negative eigenvalues. So the positive eigenvalues tell you kind of what the probability is you'll be in this plus space, and the negative eigenvalues tell you the probability you'll be in this minus space.
Do you know what the operator norm is?
Sorry.
The operator norm you're using for this?
The operator norm, that's what I said. This is also known as the one norm.
Yeah, but what was it?
That's why it's the absolute value of the first power.
Yeah, but what was it? How did you define the operator norm?
I didn't. I just said it happens.
Yeah,
it happens to be the one norm. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So next time, then we'll start to talk about implementations, different ways of building quantum computers.